with my advisor, Chris Sigurdsson, which I believe spent a lot of time here, so you probably know him, and Anthony Lewis, which probably you know from the guys who is in charge of CAM. I'll start from some general thought about dark matter because I realized that maybe not everybody is thinking about dark matter as much as I do. So, and I want to talk about the ideas of inferring the invisible, inferring something that us as humans cannot see. And if you want to go back to the origin of this concept, you need to go all the way back to ancient Greece with the work of Plato. And Plato was convinced that the world was full of harmony and symmetries. And from his friend Pythagoras, he knew that there was only 5 regular solids, 3-dimensional solids. And yet, he knew of only 4 fundamental elements of nature at the time, which were fire, earth, water, and air. And convinced of these symmetries, he postulated there should be something, a 5th element, which he called quinta essentia, essentially the 5th essence, and to match the 5 regular solids and the 5 elements, including the unknown ones. Now, fast track, more than 2,000 years later, we have the modern version of this concept with dark energy and dark matter. As far as dark matter is concerned, the first modern evidence that of its existence was from Zwicky's observation of the Kama Cluster in the early 1930s. So Zwicky looked at the Kama Cluster and using some simple virial arguments, inferred that there should be a lot of mass inside that cluster, which is not luminous. And that was the first hint that most of the matter in the universe is actually dark. Unfortunately, this observation was mostly ignored for almost 40 years and was cataloged as some anomaly that will go away while when the data gets better, and people failed to really catch on to the idea. It took until the 1970s with Vera Rubin's observation of the galaxy rotation curve for dark matter to go into mainstreams of science, and now it's a modern pillar of cosmology. 3 decades later, we might say we still don't know what dark matter is. It's almost embarrassing, but it's not for lack of trying. I mean, there's a huge effort in the scientific community, both experimental and theoretical, to try to unravel the mystery of dark matter, and yet we don't know what it is. And although, in the meantime, dark matter has taken a life on its own in the popular media. As you can see, dark matter is everywhere, books, scooters, electronics, CDs, nutritional supplement, etc., and fishing gears. Well, us scientists are still struggling to find what dark matter is, although we do know something about dark matter. We know it comprises about 83% of the matter in the observable universe. Another thing we know is that we've only observed it through gravity. And that might be actually a bit worrying, because if you look at the Einstein equation, there's 2 sides of it. So the dark matter side, in the dark matter paradigm, you're saying there's some form of matter contributing to the energy momentum density that gives rise to gravity, you see. Of course, you could just turn the thing around and say, well, it's not the energy momentum tensor that contains weird matter, but it's rather that modified gravity is really the cause for this. And as far as I know, the debate is still on. Of course, today I'll take the dark matter side and say that there is such thing as dark matter. Another thing we know is that it's cold. I mean, it doesn't move much. It doesn't free streams. So we don't want this. Another thing we want is we don't want it. We have a lot of collision because collision transport heat, and that's going to change the structure of dark matter halos, and that's going to contradict with astrophysical observations. So we don't want collisions. Also, we don't want interactions. So I mean, it's neutral into all the standard model gauge group, pretty much. So it's neutral. So we don't want that either. So that's the recipe of cold dark matter. Of course, it's a cold dark matter paradigm. It's been very successful explaining both cosmological and astrophysical observations, starting from cluster dynamics that Zwicky observed way ahead of its time, to the galaxy rotation curve, to the CMB that we managed to measure recently, the matter power spectrum that we observe and the galaxy correlation function are completely consistent with the cold dark matter paradigm. And special astrophysical objects like the bullet clusters reinforce the fact that dark matter is effectively collisionless. So dark cold dark matter is being very successful, but if that was the end of the story, I'll be out of a job and I can go home and read a book. But that's not what I want to do. I want to poke hole in that whole paradigm and try to find, is there physics beyond the cold dark matter? And as any theorist, you know, you look at your experimental friends, and you know what kind of hint you can see that are physics beyond cold dark matter. And there's two I'm going to talk about here. Of course, these are just hints. You should take these as a grain of salt, but it's something to keep at the bottom of your mind when you're working on dark matter. So the first problem is the dwarf galaxy problem, and basically. This problem can be boiled down to, you take your cold dark matter model, you plug in a computer, you make n-body simulations, and you see dark matter sub-halos and halos are distributed across the universe. And basically, the result is that what you get for a typical galaxy like the Milky Way, it should be surrounded by a lot of smaller dark matter halos. And so with this prediction, you can go on and go and look and search for these objects. The problem is that you find some of them, but not very much. So this is what this is showing here. Get the hockey stick. So we did some of the most massive subhalos, satellite galaxies, we call them here. But with cold dark matter prediction, there should be a lot of them with a smaller mass. Now this could be for two reasons that we don't see them. One, this object is not there, and you need to rethink with cold dark matter. Your cold dark matter paradigm, you need to rethink it. Or another way another solution to this problem is that these objects are there, but they're basically just dark matter dominated. They don't have much baryonic matter inside. They're very faint. You don't see them. So it can go one way or the other, but it might be a hint of physics beyond cold dark matter. Another hint is also has to do with the with these dwarf galaxies, and for a specific kind of dwarf galaxy called dwarf spherical, so people have gone on and measure the density profile of these objects. Of course, it's a very hard measurement to do, but cold dark matter predicts that the density profile of these objects should be very cuspy towards the middle. Now, what the measurement seems to show is that it's more like to be consistent with a core of constant density inside these dwarf spherical. And this is the result for two of the Milky Way satellites, where this is for the slope of the mass, the slope of the density profile, and the cusp is basically here, and the observations kind of ruled out the cusp about 2 sigma. Of course, this is not like a 5 sigma observation; it's a hint that might be physics beyond cold dark matter on a very small scale. So it's something to keep at the back of your mind. Yes. It's the slope of the density profile. It's delta log m over delta log r.
So you're saying it's steeper than how it's shallower. The density profile is shallower.
Yeah, than you think. Yeah. Okay. It's more like a core than a cusp. A final comment on this issue. This is more like a personal view. So when you compare the visible sector and the dark sector, we know that the physics of the visible sector is extremely rich. So the standard model has lepton, quarks, three families, all these gauge bosons. So very rich structure. And yet, when usually people talk about dark matter, it's a very simple one particle model, you know, without a lot of rich physics inside. But then, you know, if the visible sector is so rich, why is the dark sector has to be so poor? So it makes sense to try to explore a bit more generic and more general dark sector that includes more physics than the minimal model. So I've listed here the most popular models of dark matter. Of course, today we're going to talk about the last one, which is hidden sector bound state dark matter. And the question we want to answer is that how much free zone do current observation leave for new physics in the dark sector? And the answer is quite a bit. if you set it up properly. So let's dive into the core of this talk, which is this atomic dark matter. So I'll start with a brief introduction to the interacting dark matter model, and then dive into this atomic dark matter model and see how it's linked to the interacting dark matter model. Now, this atomic dark matter model has a very rich thermal history that we're going to spend some time discussing about. And so we want to do cosmology, so we want to talk about how perturbation evolved into this new theory. So describe all the matter power spectrum BA, how the CMB is affected, and discuss some astrophysical constraints on these models, and see where this model will take us in the future. So let me start with interacting dark matter. So interacting dark matter has an interesting history where it was initially proposed by Steinhardt and Spergel in the late 90s to try to alleviate tension between observations and a cold dark matter paradigm. And they showed some kind of NYB calculation that it should do the job, and then people went and did more in-depth simulation and showed it was quite constrained. And I think this is one of the most up-to-date constraints on interacting dark matter. So here I'm basically, this is from Jonathan Fang et al. A couple of years ago, plotting the coupling constants of the interacting dark matter versus its mass. And what you see is that, so the white region is the allowed region, the color region is ruled out, so the red region is ruled out by the bullet cluster because this is where dark matter starts interacting. So in the bullet cluster dark matter, you see it just pass through each other. Well, in this region, dark matter will not pass through each other, it will actually interact, but that's not what we see. And the yellow band is through the ellipticity of the dark matter halos. So when you look at galaxy or clusters, we observe this dark matter halos to have some triaxial ellipticity, and if dark matter was interacting, it will thermalize and form more like a sphere and not an ellipse. So observing that there are ellipses constrain the interaction rate of this dark matter. So basically, the boiled down version of this model is that you need very high mass and very low coupling constants. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
There's a merging process called liquefied
through zero, published mass
through zero,
which
does not show the
frequency. Okay. Yeah, it's true. Yeah, but the thing is,
it's called the train wreck.
Yeah, the train wreck, exactly.
So what do you have to say about?
The thing is, the bullet cluster is not as constraining as ellipticity. It's very hard to work around ellipticity. Because, I mean, ellipticity is not only rules out everything on the side, including the bullet cluster. So the boiled-down version of this is that you need very high mass, because when you have a lot of mass for a fixed dark matter density, you have very few of these particles, so you never find each other, they never interact, and you have very low very low coupling constants, again, even if the particle come close to each other, they basically don't interact. So you kind of hide your interacting dark matter through a very coupled plasma. Yeah?
Interacting dark matter is liable if it's weakly interacting as a large mass. What about axioms? And also there's a movement.
I'm focusing on the interacting dark matter that's very similar to what I'm going to talk about later here, which is this kind of massive fermions interacting with a gauge symmetry.
There's also a movement in Europe to have warm dark matter. They dismissed warm dark matter. So the movement is going to energy. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. But this is not warm dark matter, right? So in this model, they have negligible free streaming, right? So dark matter is quite cold. At late times, right? So basically, so in this specific model of that Fang et al. Talk about is basically you have two fermions, and the kinetic decoupling happened at a very early time, and after that, these fermions really don't talk to each other. So, and they don't free stream much, because they're quite cool. So it basically behaves just like cold dark matter, except you have a residual interaction in clusters if the interaction rate is too large. So now I'm going to talk about the model I'm working on. So atomic dark matter. So the atomic dark matter was the first papers with David Kaplan and all a couple of years ago, and basically the basis of the model is that it's like a copy of dark hydrogen. So you have a U1 gauge force, you have two oppositely charged fermions, for convenience we're going to call dark electron and dark protons. The sector is neutral, so there's no long range force into this theory. And we can describe the model by four parameters. So the dark fine structure constant, the binding energy of the bound state, that's the typical energy scale of the theory, the mass, and the binding energy, and the temperature of the dark sector. These parameters are subject to this consistency constraint, which ensure that the fermion mass are real and not imaginary. So I promise you this model has a rather rich thermal history. This model, in the early universe, everything is ionized. So you have this hot ionized plasma that's tightly coupled with this radiation bath in a basically perfect fluid. And so there's two, at later times, there's two important times we need to discuss. There's recombination. So when the dark plasma goes from a ionized state to a neutral state, and that's going to be very important for how perturbation grow at late times in the universe. And there's a kinetic and thermal decoupling. This is when the interaction rate between the dark radiation and the dark matter falls out of equilibrium, and as it goes below the Hubble rate, then the two sectors, the dark matter and the dark radiation, start evolving independently. And so this might be related to this, but it's not necessarily related to this. So I was with discuss, this model is much more general than just regular hydrogen, where you have certain order of things happening, where you have recombination and kinetic decoupling. Kinetic decoupling and recombination and thermal decoupling later. Here we can see that we can basically have everything, all the order possible. So we'll talk about this in detail in a minute. First, I'd like just to mention that, as in any theory, I mean, you cannot just choose your parameter to be anything you want. So in this pressure model, you have extra radiation because you have this dark photon floating around. And we know that if we have too much radiation during BBN, you start producing too much ilium. So the number of relativistic species at BBN can bound the temperature of the dark sector today to be about 3/4 of the standard model temperature. And by standard model here, I really mean CMB. So that's an upper bound with the temperature of the dark sector can be. So it needs to be cooler than the CMB. So I promise you that dark recombination is an important phase of this theory.
I guess it could be a lot colder than that and still rolled out with matter dominated.
So you say matter dominated, you mean, so this is today, so this ratio, I'm talking about the temperature today.
Sure. But so this is dark matter, so supposedly you want to...
No, this is the temperature. This is the temperature of the dark radiation. It's not
the
temperature of the dark.
But the atoms are dark matter.
Yeah, that's right.
So that's, it's not just an upper limit on their abundance. Just you know exactly what the abundance of atoms should be.
Oh no, but I'm not talking about, this is just a limit on the temperature of the radiation. It's not a limit on the abundance. I mean, the dark matter abundance is fixed by observation.
Yeah.
And I'm not playing around with this. Yep.
So how does your dark electron and dark proton acquire mass by interacting with these?
Oh, I'm not concerned about the UV completion of my theory. I'm basically approaching this as a bottom up approach where I know that CDM is almost right, but I want to tweak it a bit to induce physics but on small scales. And that's kind of the minimal model that's going to give me that. So I mean, people have done that actually. I've embedded this theory to a bigger theory where you couple it to the standard model and all these fermions get massed the proper way. But this is not really my concern. I'm more concerned about what's the late time behavior and thermal history of this theory and effects in cosmology.
sorry.
Yeah.
What's the size of oscillation for this dark matter?
Oh, we'll talk about this in quite deep, in detail. It depends on the parameters. You can have everything you want, but it needs to be quite small, because otherwise we have seen it, right? So it needs to be probably like on a kiloparsec scale. So dark atoms. So recombinations. So in a sense, the dark atom recombinations is very similar to hydrogen, but at the same time very different. What's very similar is that you cannot. So when the temperature of the dark sector falls below the binding energy, you cannot recombine directly to the ground state, because that's going to emit photons that are going to then find another neutral atom and then ionize it again, and you get no net recombination. So the way around it is to recombine to the n equal 2 state, so this is so-called case B recombination for a theoretical reason. And then from the n equal 2 state, you can cascade down to n equal 1 state through the two-photon process or the Lyman alpha transition. So the Boltzmann equation for recombination is the same as for hydrogen. This pre-factor CB encodes the probability that once you reach n equal 2 state, you can actually fall down to the ground state or be ionized again. If this CB is 1, then you reach the ground state every time you reach the n equal 2 state. What's different, though, than with hydrogen is that these rates are quite different. And I was going to spend a minute talking about this, because it turns out to be very important. So there's been studies of dark atoms before, and this is what the generic kind of recombination rate that most people use, and it's extracted from textbook by Spitzer from 1978. And there's a few, and I've identified a few problems with this that happen to be quite relevant for this theory. It misses the dependence of the dark radiation temperature. So this rate, as you see, only depends on the temperature of dark matter itself and the dark radiation, which means it misses the stimulated recombination contribution completely. As we'll see, this is very important. It fails to take into account all the IN states. And as we've learned from Seeger, Scott, and Sazlaw, this is about a 14% correction. It's a famous 1.14 fudge factor in RegFast. And this fails to capture the right behavior at low temperature and very high temperature. So what we do, we're in the 21st century. We're not in the 1970s anymore, so we can actually go and just compute these things exactly. And we use this technique developed by Yassine Ali Amoud, which is now a postdoc at IAS. And basically, we want to compute this recombination rate to the n equal 2 state, but we also want to take all into account all the other IN effects. And we do that by basically summing of all the n states way over the probability that given n state decay to n equal 2 states. And that's something you can do quite easily, and then then you don't have to solve the full 300 Boltzmann equation to get all the single single occupation of each level. And we thank Yassine for his help on doing this. So basically, you can do this. You compute these rates for and the graded TD over the binding energy and the dark matter over the radiation temperature. You can extract the leading behavior times a dimensionless function. This function is universal, which means that it works for any model. It doesn't depend on the physics. It englobes all the quantum mechanics. It doesn't depend on your choice of dark parameters. So this is a nice way to write things. And we have calculated this function. And finally, this photoionization rate can be just gotten from the recombination rate by detailed balance argument. So this is all under control and all exact. Now when you put all the pieces together, actually compute this, so how much difference does it really make? So this is, I'm plotting these for hydrogen, so the parameter from hydrogen, so the standard model parameters. And so I'm plotting, so the dash black line is just the RegFast rate. So what's used for modern CMB code today are red lines, and the crosses are fit and the exact calculation. Well, this green line is what Spitzer, which is what most people use. And what you see is that for when most recombination happens, which is this range here, the fit is pretty good, except for Spitzer, which is about 15% because it missed all the ion state effect. At early times, both approach, except ours, fails, taking into account this turnover here. Of course, for hydrogen, this is not important because hydrogen is all ionized here. But in our case, I will talk in a minute, it's quite important to get this rate right here because there will be other physics kicking in that depends on this rate. So when the two temperatures are equal, we see that the difference is quite small, and you know it doesn't matter much. However, when the temperature differs quite a bit, so when kinetic when thermal decoupling happens before recombination, so the usual approach kind of failed by like an order of magnitude or so. So this is where our calculations gets very important. So putting all the pieces together, and actually now you're integrating the Boltzmann equation to get the ionization fraction. So the fraction of free electrons, dark electron, as a function of redshift. So I've plotted here the answer with the exact rate in red and the approximate rate that most people use. And see that the overall difference is small at the end. So you kind of shift a bit the redshift of recombination. You get enough stuff at the end because you integrate over a rate that's a bit shifted over the whole range of redshift. But I'm a bit cheating here because I've assumed, so basically the exact rate here has the wrong temperature, but has the same temperature as the black line. I'll show you later what happened when you take into account the bright temperature. You see that this difference gets like an order of magnitude. So so this is what I'm going to talk about now. Yeah. Yeah. So exactly. Because I wanted to single out the effect from just the rate, and not the effect from having different temperature. Because this approximate rate cannot distinguish between the two temperatures, because it only depends on one. So I'll show you later what it does when you try to actually take into account the temperature difference. And you see, you get quite a large effect.
Yeah, but I mean, if you take TD as the three parameter of the theory, as one of the three parameters of the theory, then is it fair to say that the prediction doesn't depend on whether you use approximate rate or exact rate?
So if TD is a free, okay. So TD is a parameter you choose.
Yeah.
T dark matter is dynamically given by all the other parameters, right?
Yeah. Okay. So if that's what you're doing here. So both of these are the same.
Yeah, the same TD, but it's the wrong TD, basically. This is what I'm saying. Because I wanted to isolate the effect from the rate only. And when you take into, the thing is, I cannot show you what this approximate answer is for the right TD, because it doesn't depend on it, right? Because the approach, the usual approach, fails to take into account a stimulated recombination, which turns out to be very important when the temperatures are very different.
Yeah, I don't understand what's the difference between right TD and wrong TD, because there is...
Oh, so there's an evolution equation for temperature. And basically what's happening, I'm going to talk about this in a minute, but what's happening is that Compton eating becomes inefficient in this case. This is quite a weak coupling case, so alpha is quite small. But if you say, okay, Compton eating is inefficient, the two temperature diverges, and that's it. But if you're adding two things carefully, there's actually another mechanism, a couple other mechanisms that kicks in and keep the temperature very close to each other. And this is not taking into account here. This photoionization eating and free eating is not taking into account here. So. Mm-hmm. Yeah?
Since you have an analogy with chemistry.
Yeah, that's right.
You must be getting molecules.
Yeah.
Why not?
Yeah, I mean, so the dark periodic table is more like nuclear physics. You would have different, right? So protons, but we need some neutrons, and then from a higher state. You can have that, but I mean, I'm interested in what the minimal model I can write, right?
It is true that you could have H2 molecules.
Yeah, that's right.
That's
you can have dark chemistry.
Yeah.
But you need significant cooling, right? And so I won't be talking about that today, but this is one thing you could do. So let me talk briefly about this temperature issue since we just discussed it. So in the early universe, the frequent collision between the radiation and the fermions keeps the whole plasma in a single temperature.
It's true you need a lot of cooling to get them, but then I think it's maybe not unimportant to think about because then they also can do a good kind of work.
Yeah, you can, you can turn on molecular cooling. Yeah, that's right. But as I said, I won't be talking about this today. I thought about it, but I only have so much time today. So once the energy exchange rate between the radiation and the fermions fall below the normal rate, the two temperature decouples and dark matter temperatures start cooling adiabatically, much more than you expect in a regular cosmology. And this is, having the right temperature, as I mentioned, is necessary for the right recombination history and also for kinetic decoupling. And that kinetic decoupling is very important because that's going to tell you the scale at which perturbations in your early universe get smoothed out by acoustic damping. So I'll talk about this a bit later, but it's a key time scale that we need to really get it right to make accurate prediction. So what's the mechanism that keeps thermal equilibrium? Well, in the strong coupling regime, just Compton scattering between the dark electrons and the photon, the dark photons, just like usual baryonic plasma, so nothing new here. And the Coulomb scattering between the dark electron and the dark protons maintains the fermions themselves to a single temperature. So the Coulomb scattering, all of us going to talk today, is always extremely efficient. So the two fermions always the same temperature, whatever their mass are. In the weak coupling regime, however, so when alpha is quite small, or the dark center temperature is very cool compared to the standard model sector, then Compton heating is not efficient enough to keep the radiation and dark matter at the same temperature. And I was, when I was working on this, I kind of stumbled into this regime where the temperature was decoupling early, and then it was recombining later. Which is kind of a bit strange because recombinations and equilibrium between photoionization and recombination. So the regime I was in was basically the electrons were not interacting with the photons, but the photons were interacting with the bound state only and not the free electrons. That was a very strange regime. And I was thinking there's going to be something wrong there. And indeed, there was something wrong because you need to take into account other energy exchange mechanisms between the plasma and the radiation. And these are photoionization heating and photorecombination cooling. So I've indicated the rough scaling of these rays here. So there's also free-free heating, so Bremsstrahlung, free-free cooling, the usual Bremsstrahlung radiation, adiabatic cooling, which is always present in the expanding universe. But one important point here is that so this photorecombination cooling scale is the same power as temperature as the Hubble ray. So it goes T square, and the adiabatic cooling also goes as T square, which means that if it is important in your universe, it stays important until recombination. There's nothing that can kill it, which is a bit surprising somehow. And so the Compton heating goes at the fourth power of the temperature. So at very early time, it always dominates. But as you cool down, you can have other processes taking over. And this is the temperature equation that you solve to actually solve for the dark matter temperature. And to answer your question, so in the previous plot, there was only these terms and this term, the temperature. But now we're going to include these other terms here, which take into account this new physics that I just talked about. First, I'm just going to show you a plot what it looks for the standard case. So this is the strong coupling regime. It's like standard hydrogen. So Compton heating dominates at all time. So when this sharp decline is recombination here, so the two photoionization and free-free cooling is always unimportant in this model. And so recombination happened, and then thermal decoupling happened after. This is just like regular hydrogen. In the weak coupling case, though, you can invert things around. And now photorecombination cooling dominates over Compton heating. So Compton heating is not important in this problem. So that's a new regime that that you don't find in baryonic physics. And basically, thermal decoupling happens at recombination in this case. And this is what a temperature plot look like. And so this black line is the real temperature. We're taking into account all the physics I just described, while this red line is just taking into account Compton heating. And this is really where most of the temperature difference comes from. In the plot. So this is the plot I was talking about. So now you see when you take into account this temperature effect, you have a large difference. Here? This is Xe. This is the ionization fraction, the fraction of free electrons in the plasma. So this is the exact result, and this is the Compton only result I showed you before. So now if you take sulfur at the right temperature, you have like an order of magnitude in ionization fraction difference at the end. And that can make a huge difference if you're going to talk about concerning clusters of our galaxies, because having, you know, like 10% ionized or, you know, 0.1% ionized can be a huge difference in the interaction cross section. So this is all taken care of very carefully. Now putting all the pieces together, so we define this is a definition here. We define the decoupling temperature when the dark matter and the direct radiation differ by about 10%, and we identify different regime of this theory that I kind of allude to earlier. So the first is the kind of the regular hydrogen regime with T-rec is bigger than T-decoupling. Is the regime where they're both equal, which is basically the regime where photoionization eating is very important. And the weak coupling regime where the temperature decouples first and then recombines. And there's a regime where it doesn't recombine at all, which is the regime I was talking at the very beginning of the talk about just pure interacting dark matter. There's just no recombination. And in all cases, the kinetic decoupling is always bigger than the thermal decoupling. The four?
Yeah,
this is just pure interacting dark matter that doesn't form band state. It's the basically the plot I showed you at the beginning with the big band. It's this model where you have a very heavy fermion sitting around with very low binding, very low alpha coupling them. So don't really talk much to each other. So this is this regime. It's not really an atomic dark matter regime. Right?
So you have lots of like a plasma.
It's like a plasma, but it's very weakly coupled and very dilute.
Very weakly coupled and very heavy.
So the particles don't really find each other much.
Well, individual particles don't find each other possibly, but I mean you could have collective interactions. I'm just saying that. You cannot have two chunks of this plasma pass through each other because even though you can have like two string instability and things like that.
I don't think so. I mean, this is basically the model that Jonathan Feng and all considered, and the bulk cluster constraint wasn't that constraining. It is because this is so dilute that particles basically don't find each other. Even if they pass through, they don't really find each other.
Yeah, but I mean, interactions in plasma aren't particle interactions. They are collective interactions. That is, you have collective excitations that interact with each other, than individual particles.
Yeah, but if they're very massive, these particles are very massive, but very hard to excite these nodes.
Okay. Massive compared to what?
Well, if they're very massive, it means that there are really few of them, right? So I don't think this is much of a constraint. I mean, imagine you have one particle per megaparsec or something, right? So then trying to find in the Hubble time another particle to interact with. I mean, this is very dilute.
No, I understand. Is that how dilute it is? I don't think it's that one. It's that dilute.
I don't know. But this is not. Oh boy, what did I do? This is not the atomic dark matter regime. This is like a plasma regime.
Yeah.
So what did I do?
No, it's just that usually in plasma you have much more interactions than in the neutral regime.
But this is I don't know a lot about that specific sector, because mostly it's not a bound state. It's not a bound state. It's not atomic dark matter, basically. I want to put the emphasis on that this kinetic decoupling is very important. So for this dwarf galaxy problem I was talking about. Because it basically set what's the smallest mass, halo, dark matter halo mass it can have at late times. So getting this kinetic decoupling right is very important. So now we're on to the cosmology with all of this. So we have to solve for the perturbation equation. Now, compared to regular cold dark matter, these equations at the top, it looks like much more like baryon. It's exactly the same equation as baryon, except now they decouple through dark radiation. And this is the momentum transfer rate. It's very important for kinetic decoupling. So when this momentum transfer rate is about order of magnitude of the Hubble rate, this is when kinetic decoupling happened, and the two sectors, the dark radiation and dark fermions, can evolve independently. Now, if this is large, this equation becomes very stiff, and basically this said the velocity of the dark matter is equal to the velocity of the radiation. Basically, what happened physically is that these dark matter belts enter the horizon and start collapsing in themselves, but then this the pressure from the photons, then that contributes some kind of spring force, right? This like harmonic oscillator, and these photons just drive these oscillations inside the horizon until the two fluids decouple. And we'll see this in a minute. And basically, it's the photon that drives everything. The photon just do their own thing, and the dark matter is along for the ride, as long as the momentum transfer rate is high enough. So this kinetic momentum transfer rate basically is this photons to dark matter ratio times this dark opacity, which has two components, which is the usual kind of Thompson scattering component that's present for regular baryon, but also has this other piece, which is from interacting with the bound states. This piece is not important for hydrogen, but it turns out to be very important for atomic dark matter. So it's basically, instead of interacting with a free electron, you're going to interact with a bound state, and that's again that can still transfer momentum to the plasma. So there's four different cases, as I just mentioned. Outside the horizon, nothing really is happening. It just looks like cold dark matter. The perturbation is not evolving, so we won't really talk about this. Once it enters the horizon, it starts oscillating. And as long as the frequency of oscillation of the photons is smaller than the momentum transfer rate, the photons can really drag along the dark matter in a single fluid. Once the frequency of these spherical waves gets larger than this momentum transfer rate, then the dark matter cannot keep up with the photons anymore. And that leads to a lot of friction in this fluid. And that, as you can see, this damp, it's like as a damping and dense perturbation on these scales. Yeah?
The crucial thing about dark matter cosmology is the particles are collisionless.
Mm-hmm.
There's no pressure wave dissipation.
Yeah.
That's why you fit that open against the
The thing is, you're going to recombine, and then after the recombination, this thing behaves like cold dark matter. So it recombines early enough in the universe, when the modes oscillating are very small, then all the other modes that enter after basically just behave like cold dark matter. So you actually retain the success of cold dark matter on larger scales, up to the kinetic decoupling scale. And all the further scale get down because of these oscillations.
So you need these dark matter
modes
to really
fade
to neutral that.
Oh, you do, yeah.
Otherwise, you're going to get into trouble.
Yeah, that's right. But it's almost true, but you need to keep in mind this interacting dark matter model where you have these free fermions floating around and not being bound. And the important time scale is the kinetic decoupling. Kinetic decoupling happened early enough, then the dark photon is free stream away, and the dark matter is left to do its own thing and can start grow and basically just behave like cold dark matter, even though it's not a bouncing. So the kinetic decoupling is a very important thing to get right. And that's why I worked so hard to get the thermal history right.
The question is, they found enough before C.
In which sense?
In the sense that you have to falsify this.
Mm-hmm.
So if the things, the atoms are too bound, so they're electrically neutral.
Yeah.
Then it looks just like all the dark matter.
That's right. That's
right.
Collision. Yeah.
So how do you distinguish between the two models?
Well, so this is a model where on cosmological scale, it just looks like all dark matter, but what's different is very small scale. The scales of galaxies and dwarf galaxies. This is where it's different, right? So this is where the two cold dark matter and this model is going to differ, because they make different prediction for what the kinetic decoupling is, what's the smallest halo mass you have. We have this DAO, we're going to talk about this acoustic oscillation. that happen on a very small scale. So this is where so all the interesting physics is all at this very small
scale. So I guess to be fair, you push the parameters so that these features are there and not quite observed yet.
But
the model would be falsified already. So that's
So you push it, you need to push a binding energy high enough so you don't you don't screw up your model power spectrum on a large scale. So this is what we just talked about. These and just plotting the evolution, these perturbations to the strong coupling regime. So these perturbations go inside the horizon, oscillates, and then recombination happens while the frequency of oscillation is still smaller than the interaction rate. And so the decoupling is very fast. And basically, these oscillations are undamped because the frequency is always smaller than the momentum transfer rate. And the only difference in amplitude is due to that you don't get the horizon kick when you cross the horizon. So this is called dark matter. When you cross the horizon, you get a little kick. And you miss the logarithmic growth during radiation domination. And that combined cannot explain this difference. So there's no acoustic damping in the strong coupling regime. And this is the regime where the DAO are the most important. So transitioning from strong coupling regimes to the weak coupling regime, so these waves are oscillating, and once the frequencies go higher than the momentum transfer rate, you get these frictions, and the two waves you decouple, and dark matter start growing, like regular cold dark matter will form a much reduced amplitude. So this is the case where there's a lot of acoustic damping from all that oscillates a lot in the horizon. And the weak coupling regime, this is the case where when the moment of the horizon, the momentum transfer rate is already lower than the frequency. So basically, it's only in the damping mode, and you get less of damping very fast, and then you decouple and start growing from a much reduced amplitude very, very fast in time. So putting all this together, you get the matter power spectrum. It's exactly what you expect from this kind of theory. So you have a cutoff scale corresponding to kinetic decoupling. Kinetic decoupling is this last mode into the horizon just before kinetic decoupling. It has time to go into compression, and then there's enough pressure to push it back and dilute it a bit. But that's it. And it can start grow like cold dark matter. This is the scale here. We call this a K cut, which is a cutoff scale of the matter power spectrum. So you have this DAO regime, which is like this undamped oscillation that I talked about, where the only difference is from the logarithmic growth and the kick. And you know, I just put the BAO to compare. There's so much more dark matter than baryons. So the BAO is much bigger, the DAO much bigger. So this is strong coupling case. And the weak coupling case, I can imagine, it's much more acoustic damping. The DAO dies very fast. And then again, K cut is the kinetic decoupling scale. So this kinetic decoupling, I mention it a lot because it's very important. So I've already mentioned the definition. This is just the mode enter the horizon when kinetic decoupling is happening. But you can translate this into a minimal mass but for the smallest dark matter halos. But since we know there are dwarf galaxies, these are rough lower bound in what K cut should be, and should be greater than 200 inverse megaparsec or something to actually just fit basic observation. So you want it to be quite far away in the tail of the matter power spectrum. I'll briefly mention. So what does this model do to CMB? There's one main effect, and it has nothing to do with dark matter really. It's just the fact that this model has more radiation in it, and you shift matter radiation equality, so the size of the horizon is not exactly shifted. So you shift all the peaks to the right. It's exactly what you expect if you have more radiation. And also, it's slightly harder to see, but the odd peaks is slightly suppressed, and that's because dark. So in these models, so matter radiation equality has been shifted, so dark matter doesn't have as much time to grow. The potential well doesn't have as much time to grow, so the compression wave is not as intense. So this is the two main effects, but so we don't expect any CMB signal from this. So the most stringent constraint. Well, so this is what I'm plotting here. is basically ruled out by BBNR. And it's just, I was just trying to show. I mean, we've measured where these quite accurately where this first peak is and second peak. Yeah.
How much?
Oh, it's very similar to BBN bound emission at the beginning, right?
Like
so the temperature needs to be three quarters or half of the center
because,
of the cycle.
I mean, you know, there is evidence for extra.
Yeah, that's right.
SPT
and others. That's right. So, well, this was one of the motivations for the model in the first place, but.
So it's not obvious that it's ruled out. It might be carefully
somehow. It's ruled out. I'm just saying that it's not like. A compelling CMB signature in the sense that it could be, there's a lot of things that can give you this on top of atomic dark matter. Because it's not really atomic dark matter that gives you this, it's just the extra radiation.
Sure.
This is really what I meant.
The aim of the power spectrum to the live CM fits within a few percent.
So what is?
The live CM fit
yeah.
The aim of the power spectrum.
Yeah.
It's now within a few percent.
Mm-hmm.
That's where I propose help.
That's right.
You don't have much room.
Yeah, you don't have much room, that's right. But this, I mean, even with the data always in the dabbing tail, we still have a bit of freedom for extra relativistic degree of freedom, or one more neutrino. So this model, since this model adds radiation, it can, it's allowed, it's basically not ruled out by CMB. This is the main point.
It's not verified either.
Oh no! But I was mentioning there's a lot of model that gives you the signature. That's why I'm saying there's no interest in seeing the signature from atomic dark matter, because there's so many models that can give you the same signature.
Regarding the matter power spectrum, the things
are presently
the SPSSD.
Yeah. Oh, I can go back.
It's not from small k. Data is very sparse.
Yeah, it goes all the way back.
The reason is that the
yeah.
large luminous red galaxies, which they use in SPSS, are always seen up to the same amount of light.
That's right.
So, therefore, when you do a Fourier analysis of the correlation function of the other, you can't distinguish acoustical oscillations, even luminous.
Oh yeah, it's hard, right? And I mean these scales are highly nonlinear too, and there's lots of
the
there's lots of effect. That's right.
So it's very hard to complete the effects with dates.
Yeah.
It's very difficult to make this way to solve to verify this.
Yeah, but at the same so this is there's two things. So first is are you gonna get any structure below this k cap? So can nonlinear effect kind of raise this back to the CDM level? I don't know. This is something that needs to be worked out. But for now, basically we assume that there's really no structure. This is like a strong cutoff.
The slope is very important.
Yeah, the slope is very important.
Because modified gravity theory like Monte.
Yeah.
Slope is way off. So it can never work. So Milgram's model.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
There's my modified gravity.
John, I think maybe we should let Francis finish his talk.
Anyway. I'm almost done. And I want to finish by talking about some astrophysics constraints. This is one of the most constraining I was mentioning the ellipticity of dark matter halos. We observe clusters and galaxy dark matter halos, we have some ellipticity. And that constrains how much interaction there can be in the dark matter sector. Because if there's a lot of interaction, the whole halo thermalizes, and it looks more like a sphere than an ellipse. And using some simple argument that the rate of interaction in like an object like a galactic halos or cluster is less than the typical dynamical time of that object, you get this constraint, which basically favor very low alpha, so very weakly coupled dark matter, very massive dark matter, and very tightly bound dark matter. So you need atoms that have like kV scale binding energy, can have a GeV mass and alpha 10 to the minus 3, 10 to the minus 4. So these low alpha regimes, exactly the regime where all these new physics I talked about, these photonization heatings and so on, gets very important. So it was important to actually capture this physics to obey this electricity constraint. So some key points. So taking into account everything I've talked about, what's the take-home point? So the theory of dark matter is a simple and effective testbed for physics beyond the standard the CDM, because they introduce interaction on small scale, but keeps the success of dark matter on large scale. It has a rich thermal history, and kinetic decoupling is delayed compared to a typical WIMP model. It can bring some interesting physics down to observable scale. So I already mentioned this. So it makes new and easily calculable prediction to cut off these DIOs I mentioned. And it's not rolled up observation. That's always nice. And so what's the future of this model? To basically wrap up all the possible constraints on these four parameters into a single entity that still didn't be worked out. The important question is, are these DIO detectable? As John mentioned, it's a hard thing to do. These scales are highly nonlinear, and so it's something that needs to be done. So another thing you could do is add a kinetic detector with the standard model, and then you can talk about direct detection and indirect detection for this model. This has been done. This is the original Kaplan papers. This is really what they've done. You consider the direct detection signals of this model. And so one thing also that might be important is that now you have atomic dark matter, and then when structures start to collapse, how does this model behave when these structures start to collapse? That's something I would like to consider too. I would like to talk, I had something else to talk about, but it's a bit past 12, so I don't know. Okay, good.
I don't know how long it is.
It's 5 minutes, but it's fine.
Go for it.
Okay. Linked to what I just talked about, I'm also interested in, we talk about these cutoffs that this atomic dark matter model can give you, and so we mentioned that these scales are highly nonlinear, and it's the data is very sparse. How would you detect these? And it involves actually a technique to actually go and detect these things on Galactic scales, because this is really where it should matter. And basically, you want to use trondensing observation of a single lens that magnifies the background quasar, and that makes multiple images of this quasar. And by looking at all these observables from these four images, you can try to reconstruct the dark matter distribution inside the galactic halos. This is the goal of this. And the different dark matter theories, the same table as before, predict different cutoffs. And by measuring the cutoff, you can kind of rule out dark matter models. For example, so we talked about bound state, it's somewhere up there. If I did any cutoff, you can really rule out dark matter model. And that's a very nice thing to do. So I mentioned the lensing. So by looking at the background quasar from Earth through strong lenses, you can infer what the matter distribution is inside, and you can also infer what's the substructure distribution inside. That's really the goal of what we're trying to do. So to do this, we need a precise measurement of the time delay, the positions, and the magnification. And these three quantities are key because they probe different part of the gravitational potential. And if you measure these three things simultaneously, then you can basically reconstruct the gravitational potential inside and infer useful information about substructure distribution. And I'm involved in an experimental project to actually go on and measure these things called Omega.
Can I ask, there were these previous observations that wanted to measure very similar things to like Chris Kachanik and these guys wanted to measure the Hubble constant.
Yeah, that's right. Time delays.
Are any of those observations, are there any observations in the CAM?
Yeah,
Well, no. It's mostly because you need to look at these things for a very long time to get precise time delays. And so first you need to do a long time, a single object, but you also want to look at a sample of objects for a long time. So, and that's because, so you assume that you have this galactic halos and you have a sub-halo population inside, and every galactic halo is the same sub-halo population inside, and statistically. And by measuring a lot of these galaxies, you can actually infer useful information about a sub-halo population. By only measuring one galaxy, you don't really learn much. You learn a bit, but it might. So this is what you're doing. But it's not the same goal. So what's, how do we do this? So you want to compute the statistic of strong lens observable from first principle. So it's really like a pen and paper calculation. But the challenge is basically to normalize all the possible way you can arrange sub-halos inside the dark matter halo. So this is three examples where you have different sub-halos population that gives you the same observables, same images, same magnification, and so on. And how do you properly marginalize over this to actually extract useful information? So there's two key points. First is that so we consider point dark matter clumps, and they basically, you can add them linearly. So the contribution to each image is just linear and independent. And also, you can subtract the smooth component of the dark matter halos from the substructure population in a linear way. So this is the two key point of our analysis. And the nice thing about the first point is that the sum of linearly independent random variables is a huge theory about that. And you can use all these tools that's been developed about the sum of random independent variables to actually extract useful information about the substructure population. So the way we do this, we use this characteristic function method. You give you statistics by large number of substructure, and we assume low density symmetry. So the basic structure of the calculation, so you want to compute these PDFs of the substructure population. The full expression is the first integral here. It's going to be intractable. It's like in 3n dimensional.
So you're assuming just point sources?
Yeah, at the first stage. So point sources. And when this is done, we like to take into account the structure of each clump.
Yeah, but I mean, you know it's not a good approximation.
It's a good approximation as long as there's no image inside the Einstein radius of each clump. Right? So, it only breaks down if you have one of these clumps extremely close to an image. Right, and then the structure of the clump becomes quite important.
Yeah,
it's just further away, and the typical Einstein radius of these clumps are very small. So for most of the cases, this is completely fine. But so this first PDF can be intractable. But what we do is simply compute the PDF for a single clump. So what's the PDF for the observables, the magnification, the time delays, the position, given that one clump that I move around, an average of the whole halo. And once I know that, and this is basically you can compute this by hand, the characteristic function, which is basically a Fourier transform of this PDF to the n power, is basically the PDF of the whole system with n clumps in it. So it's a nice tool, and that's all based on the fact that it's a random, independent random variable. So for this project, so we have done this one clump PDF that I mentioned it. We have this proof of principle calculation principle. Of course, if you have like a billion clumps, you need computers to do these Fourier transform properly. So we're working on that. And we like to extend from point masses to actually extended sources. And we like to apply our method to actually real lenses, like real lenses and real data analysis. And that's it. And that's it for this. So I just wanted to mention this. And that's it for me. Thank you very much.